WZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Richard Cantu. We are hearing from one of the federal inspectors general who were fired Friday night by President Trump. Former Interior Department Inspector General Mark Greenblatt says among the at least 17 got the axe, he was appointed by Trump and stayed during the Biden administration.
There's no unifying theme. There's no common understanding as to why certain folks were removed and why certain folks were not.
Multiple sources tell ABC News that Ed Martin, acting U.S. attorney for Washington, D.C. and Stop the Steal promoter, has initiated a review of the office's prosecution of more than 1,500 January 6th rioters. All residents of the Pacific Palisades section of Los Angeles are being allowed back in to evaluate what's left. They're allowed in only from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., and residents of some parts still have to have a police escort. This is ABC News.
I'm James Kelly with WBZH News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WBZH website at buzzofthenorth.com.
The Chiefs beat the Bills. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. NFL, the Kansas City Chiefs held on to beat the Bills 32-29. Quarterback Patrick Mahomes on having the chance to be the first team to win three Super Bowls in a row.
It's just so hard to get to the Super Bowl, and I don't take it for granted. And to be able to do it again at Arrowhead was special. I mean, last year it was awesome. You get there and you win it, but you're at a different stadium. And then being able to win it at Arrowhead, these moments that I'll have for the rest of my life.
Bills quarterback Josh Allen now being 0-4 in the postseason against Kansas City.
It's not fun, but to beat the champs, you gotta beat the champs, and we didn't do it tonight.
The Chiefs will face the Eagles on Sunday, February 9th in Super Bowl 59. College basketball, the Wisconsin Badgers beating Nebraska 83-55. Nebraska has now lost six in a row. NBA, the Bucks are in Salt Lake City tonight to take on the Utah Jazz inside the Delta Center. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Here's a community reminder for you from the Buzz of the North. The Hayward Community Food Shelf is available for you each first Saturday of the month. Located at the Hayward Community Food Shelf at 16216 U.S. Highway 63 in Hayward. Again, the food shelf is available the first Saturday of the month from 9 a.m. until 12 noon. Another community reminder for you from the Buzz of the North.
This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. So, how'd week one work out for you, huh? Was it everything you dreamed it would be, Red Hats? Was it everything you were told? Was it everything you fantasized? Did it give you that warm, fuzzy feeling? Was it everything your little heart could have imagined? Was it as good as scoring the winning touchdown you never scored, or getting the girl you never got, or that job you were never going to get? Was it that? Did you get all tingly in the panties and all that warm, fuzzy feeling down your leg? Did that happen? Was it all that? Did it do it for you? Did you get there? Was it the January 6th criminals who literally took a dump on our nation's sacred halls and walked out of prison rubbing history's nose in it? Was that what it was? Or was it the ICE raids that invaded workplaces and schools and churches? Was that it? Did it make the willy go? Or was it making discrimination great again? Overturning Executive Order 11-246, is that it? That something that's been in place since 1965, is that it? You know, because here's the thing. This is... I want to know how deep we have to go. Where is the depravity line? Where is that place where you go, that's too far? Where is that place where you go, no, this isn't who we are? Where is that place where you go, hey, you've overreached. We just wanted cheap eggs. We wanted cheap gas. We wanted, you know, to be able to buy stuff again. We didn't want all of the absolute insanity. We're going to take over Canada and Greenland and Panama. And oh, now here's the thing. And I've had these conversations with people go, but, you know, he won. And yeah, he won because a lot of people didn't bother to show up. About 30% of the country voted for him. That's it. And as I've been saying all along, the solutions will come out of the savagery. I think a lot of people tuned out because of one reason or another. They just didn't think Biden was smart, old, and was too old, or Harris was, you know, too black. I don't know what the answer was. I don't know what kept people away. I don't know if it was Gaza. I had a lot of people told me, oh, you know, Genocide Joe. Okay, well, what's Trump going to do? You know what he's going to do? We're just gonna clean out Gaza, evidently, which is Trump's idea. It's gonna be Egypt, Jordan. You take some of them, and we'll just wipe it off the map. Won't worry about it. Again, you know, it's an idea, and it's what you voted for. And the crazy is not going to stop just here. For instance, you know, the new CIA guy, you know, said COVID came from a lab. And at this point, does it really matter? You know, we lived through it. There was a lot of horrible stuff that happened, good, bad, indifferent. But does it really matter if it was accidentally leaked by a janitor selling some fish or monkey brains or a bat in a wet market? Or if it was, oops, someone in the lab got sick and took it out? Or are we saying that the Chinese did it on purpose? And does it make COVID any less or more dangerous? What's interesting to me is the very people who said, well, it's just like the flu. Will you now shut up? It's not just like the flu. This is now a weapon. It's what we're being told. Came out of a lab. And now that it's a weapon that's been released, you know, will the red hats stop saying, duh, it's just like the red flu. The frustrating part of all this is it's been a Trump week of just constant assault. A constant assault on your senses. And look, I've had a number of friends call me and go, I can't do it. I can't watch all of this depravity. I can't watch all of the suffering. I say, look, you're going to have to. Because I truly believe, as I've said, the solutions will come out of their savagery. The suffering that comes because of their savagery is what's going to pull the 70% that didn't vote for him in a direction that says, this isn't who we are. This isn't what we want. This isn't what America is about. But as I've said before, the only way we as a nation unite is in a moment of crisis. And America, we're in crisis. The wealthy are cashing in. The corporate interests are going to get all they could possibly want. And, well, the politically connected and our oligarchs, they're going to never have it so good. Because while we're watching the dumpster fire, while we're watching what Trump is and what he does, they're going to rob us blind. They're going to deregulate. They're going to give themselves tax cuts. They're going to do all of they're going to attack labor laws. They're going to gut workers' ability to hold them in check. Now, for me, the hope is that, go ahead, you know, do it. We know what you're going to do. And Trump has done everything we knew he was going to do. So don't go, oh, I'm surprised. There's no surprise here. You knew it was coming. We've been telling you. Project 2025, yeah, it's real. The vetting process to get good patronage loyalists into the real. So don't go, I didn't know. You knew. You knew. So if you voted for Trump, this is on you. But as they do what they're going to do, and we know what's coming, it's incumbent upon us to go, we've got to come forward with the solutions and the ideas for the future. We just can't be against Trump. We've got to have better ideas. That's going to win over those people is what, 100 and million people or whatever who didn't bother to vote. That's what we need to be doing. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, Jeff Hauser is going to be here from the Revolving Door Project to talk about something that they're rolling out. Right back after this. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, again, I asked the question, was week one everything you thought it was going to be? Did it make you all tingly in the panties? I want to hear, Red Hats. Tell me, was it wonderful? Did you get all the things that you'd ever got for Christmas? Did you get the pony? Because here's the thing. You know, there's a lot of executive orders. There's a lot of, we're going after. There's a lot of bluster. A lot of drinking from the fire hose, if you will. And as we've been saying here on the program for quite some time, there's going to be a lot of that. A lot of the chasing the being the cat, chasing the laser pointer or the string, whatever. But the dangerous stuff, the really bad stuff, is what's going to be not out in front. It's why our CEO class has jumped in bed with Trump. And here to share some thoughts on week one with the CEO class, with their snouts deeply in the government trough, I've asked my good friend Jeff Hauser to come share some thoughts. Jeff is the executive director of the Revolving Door Project. You can check out their website, therevolvingdoorproject.org. They've got a corruption calendar, and they're paying attention to exactly what I've been saying. Jeff, thanks for taking time for us.
I'd love to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, how bad was week one?
I mean, week one was terrific if you happen to be a billionaire, especially if you're from big tech. Let's say your goal in life is to make artificial intelligence the next big thing, even if there is no proven value for it. I mean, obviously, if you're in high school and you don't like writing essays, there might be real value to ChatGPT at this point. But for society, not so much. But if you have been one of the beneficiaries of trillions of dollars of new stock market wealth as part of the artificial intelligence bubble, this was a great week because President Trump has committed his administration to building as many data centers in this country as possible and to providing each one of those data centers with electricity. Because the dirty secret of artificial intelligence is that to whatever extent it does or doesn't work, it eats energy for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. It creates an enormous amount of new demand for electricity, which is going to lead to higher electricity prices for all of us, and also a lot more natural gas and coal being used, and so therefore emissions into the atmosphere. It also means eminent domain. So we're going to see lots of people losing their property across the country because these voracious data centers and artificial intelligence companies want their land. So we're seeing all sorts of weird stuff happening across the country. And President Trump has put his administration at the forefront of making that happen, just so that people like Sam Altman and Microsoft leaders and OpenAI, Anthropic, all these companies are going to do really well. And then Elon Musk is going to get a lot of other stuff. So
yeah, Elon Musk is going to get rewards. but wasn't Musk against this AI plan? Because I got to think that he wanted that.
Well, yeah. So they all want to suck at the government teat But they also don't want their competitors to, because to some extent, the way that the artificial intelligence rollout is being sold to the market is that they're going to be winners and losers. And so Elon Musk had a really kind of dramatic breakup with Sam Altman and some other CEOs a couple of years ago. There's a lot of litigation going on. And so Elon Musk is investing hugely in artificial intelligence via his company. And he's upset at the fact that Trump is helping out other billionaires with their efforts, which will be in competition. Because the way you get rich in this country is not competition. It is figuring out a way to not have competition.
Absolutely.
And Elon Musk understands that.
No. And look, I had someone say some pretty nasty things about my mother being a welfare queen. Because when I was a child, we were on and off welfare several times. The true welfare queen, if you really want to look into it, Elon Musk. I mean, oh my gosh, this guy has taken more than half of cities. When you look at the amount of money that our government has given him, and
Barack Obama should own a large chunk of Tesla.
Exactly, and this is where
what the Obama administration did for them.
Right, and this is where these people, they talk about how much they hate government, how much they want to destroy government, but boy, they've sure figured out how to line their pockets. And I think that's what we're going to see the next at least 2 years, as Trump does his retribution thing, as he throws what against the wall just to get attention. We're going to see the real welfare queens. The ones who live in the C-suites and who dine in at the top of penthouses and buildings and have their own private golf clubs. We're going to see those people with their snouts, well, their whole head in the trough.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, one of the things that we're also tracking is that even when there are some a little bit unexpected cabinet appointments, so RFK Jr., who I'm not a fan of, but is definitely not a traditional Republican pick at Health and Human Services,
just a coup,
a former, like a daughter of a Teamster as Secretary of Labor. If you start looking at the deputy secretary in each of those departments, you start seeing traditional Republican lobbyist types. So I think the corporations and your billionaire class, they don't get tricked and they don't get distracted. And so if you're wondering, how is there a sort of pro-labor secretary? It's because the CEOs are like, don't worry, we're going to hem her in. She's not going to have any real power. So we are seeing that across the executive branch, sure, in the agriculture department. You name the department, there are people there to make sure that the corporate class should be very, very happy.
And look, they're firing career bureaucrats, as we speak, to put in, social media tested, loyalty tested, patronage hires to do everything that the billionaire class wants. And that hasn't gotten as much reporting as I think it should. Look, we've been talking about it for over a year when Project 2025 came out and they were doing this vetting. And I was saying, this is making patronage great again. And, Donald Trump could have disavowed as much as he wants. That's what they're doing.
Yeah, and they're getting rid of people who are really genuinely boring and non-ideological. If you are willing to stick it out as a senior civil servant in this country, that means you were okay with George W. Bush's presidency. In fact, you stuck around for Trump's presidency. Like, you have a pretty significant tolerance for right-wing governance. So the idea that the people who are being displaced by Donald Trump are these left-wing, Jacobin-reading, intellectual lefty types or whatever, is just ludicrous. Yeah. It's not just because I know a lot of these people by living in Washington, D.C., or having worked in government myself. It's just common sense that somebody who stayed in government in the last couple of decades has been willing to have some pretty right-wing Republican president. So you got to ask, what is wrong with those people from the perspective of Trump administration? And I think it's just, they know stuff. And if you know stuff, you might disagree and it might get a little bit embarrassing. No. So rather than deal with that embarrassment or sense of shame, you fire them.
Yeah, I mean, they might overreach. Like, you know, I would argue the last week, but, you know, I think it's going to get a whole lot worse. But I want to talk about the data centers and stuff because, you know, I look at Elon Musk doing the whole brain chip thing. I look at these data centers. I look at all this AI and all this technology and all these tech, you know, companies coming together and surrounding themselves at the feet of Trump. You know, I've got a lot of red hats who are crazy that, you know, we're going to have, the liberals are going to bring social credit scores and they're going to bring this kind of internet tracking and they're going to bring, you know, all of this stuff. I've had so many right-wing conspiracies thrown at me that, you know, it makes me wonder, is this another one of those, it's not a cautionary tale, it's their playbook and it's what they're going to do. And I don't want to put on, a tinfoil hat, but it seems like they're laying the groundwork to collect a lot of information on us and, you know, have a lot of levers into our lives.
Yeah, I mean, and to some extent, the ship is, or I guess the horse is out of the barn a bit on this, unfortunately. Like, there's been a lot of defeats that privacy advocates have suffered in recent decades. And the amount of information that the private sector has on us is quite disturbing. But there have been limits to how badly that information can be used against us as people. And I think one of the unfortunate goals that promulgators of artificial intelligence have is to do more with that data. So if you are an insurance company and you're trying to figure out who's a good health risk or who's a bad health risk, the more information they can gobble up information and discern ways to not turn down coverage of people who might have health risks. They can do lots of stuff with this data. That's a lot of the types of things I think artificial intelligence is going to be used for, is to weaponize the privacy losses that we've already suffered and make them much more consequential.
No, and that's, again, my red hats. Be very afraid of your own people. You voted for this. This is what you wanted. And I fear we get what you want. Now, they were, you know, big tech wasn't the only one who did really well. Privatization, and I said, look, that's going to be the name of the game in everything from our government for the next 2 years. But more privatization on the prison front, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, this was not a surprise given, like, the past people like Pam Bondi, the attorney general. But Trump is got rid of the Biden era effort to rein in privately operated criminal detention facilities. Like, we should not have people who have an economic incentive in people being held in detention. That doesn't mean you have to support complete abolition. They're going to still be prisons, but you'd rather have that be part of the public system rather than having these private actors who, on the one hand, tend to treat people really terribly in their control. There's all sorts of evidence they treat people worse. They don't save any money in the course of doing it because they have to make a profit. So they tend to cost more, treat people less well, and they then exert political power to try to increase the number of people detained because it's in their interest, right? Like, what's better than having 1,000 detention beds? Well, 2,000 detention beds.
Exactly.
Especially if you're making a lot of money for each one of them.
And you look at a lot of these contracts, they've got minimum occupancy numbers that governments have to meet or they got to pay for it, which is, you know, you think Hilton or, you know, Holiday Inn or any of the hotel companies around this country, they would love to have a minimum number of heads in beds each night.
Yeah, absolutely. Each night you have a bed that is not occupied. It's, you put that money into building it and maintaining it, and you're paying out your banknote on it, and you want to make money off it. You want to make more money than you're paying. And that's going to create all sorts of perverse incentives for the system to bring more people in and maybe alter the sort of prosecutorial discretion. Like, maybe there's like a first time 18-year-old who's just done, you know, just something not great, but do you want to put that, give that person a big scare and let them get back on the right track? Or do you want to put them in detention, which could alter the course of their entire life? Well, all of a sudden you're creating an economic incentive for detention.
Yeah, and look, here in Pennsylvania where I live, there was a case of that a couple of years ago. In fact, you know, look, I love Joe Biden, but I don't know how you pardon that guy. We had that Cash for Kids scandal that went on where just what you said, you know, minor crimes ended up being, you know, long detention sentences, all for the money. And anytime you put privatization and a profit motive ahead of the social need of the commons, you got problems. And look, with all of these rounding up of these immigrants and rounding up of the others, a privatized prison system should scare all of us.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially you see with the, at times at least, Trump has talked about focusing on immigrants, deportation efforts of migrants, of people who've actually committed crimes, which, you know, makes a lot more sense than going after law-abiding, peaceful people who are contributing members of our society.
You mean like raiding work sites and schools and churches? You mean that?
Yeah, I mean, so that's like he's going after to rack up numbers. And that's exactly the type of perverse behavior that privatization focuses on. So it's not only morally wrong to do it, it's also likely to some extent influenced by this corruption.
Last line of questioning I got for you. You know, look, it's going to be a long 2 years, potentially. It's going to be a long 4 years of Trump, but potentially 2 years of Republicans controlling both the House, the Senate, and the White House. How are we getting through this? What advice are you giving folks?
Well, I mean, for one thing, like, we should not turn on each other. And what that means is if somebody else is doing opposition to Trump in a way that you don't like, you can say that that's not for me. But I think we should be generous toward our allies and steadfast against the things that are wrong. And so I think we want to stay focused as much as possible. The people with the broadest reach should be focused on the economic and material impacts of having a corrupt president.
Yep.
But I also don't want to attack people who are defending any of the diverse interests that Trump is assaulting, because, you know, if that's what motivates you, it's certainly admirable. And maybe that's not the best message to win a state as an elected candidate in 2026. But, you know, we as Americans, we're not all running for office. We don't have to poll test everything we say. So I do want us, even as I agree that like the strategy, the big picture is to focus on the material impacts, I think we should just try to have each other's backs as much as possible. We all have to stay sane in our individual personal lives. So that doesn't mean we have to be on a ledge, you know, threatening like awful things and thinking about politics 24/7. As much as you have the luxury to not think about it 24/7, you shouldn't. But let's have some charity in our heart for people who are doing resistance in their own way. And I don't think we should be as cynical as I think I'm seeing people be about what happened in 2017. I think the Women's March was commendable. I think it motivated a lot of people. And just because in the last few years, we have to some extent frittered away the upside of the resistance to Trump in the first term, doesn't mean that everything we did in that those 4 year stretch was mistaken.
No, look, I think you have to come up with a clear vision. I think Democrats have to figure out what it is that their positions are and hammer those constantly when things don't go as they're not going to go, because eggs aren't going to be a buck a dozen again. Gas ain't a dollar a gallon now. In fact, eggs have gone up. Gas prices went up 15 cents again in my neighborhood. When the economy doesn't turn around and all the stuff that Trump's doing actually makes things worse, Democrats have to be there with a clear, consistent message, and they've got to be forceful in this. This is where you can't, in a street fight, offer to hold someone's coat. You got to get in there, ball up your digits, and you got to fight with Trump. Enough of the cowering. I'm tired of it.
Yeah, I mean, and then the other thing is, when stuff goes badly, let's not give this guy, Donald Trump, of all people, the benefit of the doubt. When things happen that are bad, blame him. No one has ever claimed more ability to make stuff happen through their sheer force of will. Yeah. Donald Trump says everything is going to go right. So egg prices are going up now. And they're not that's not Donald Trump's fault. I mean, that's bird flu. But when egg prices went up under Joe Biden, they were also due to bird flu. And no one gave Joe Biden the benefit of the doubt. And I really don't think Democrats like have to be consistent here. I mean, or they should be consistent, which is, you blame stuff on the incumbent. That is what Republicans did. They did so in an intellectually dishonest way.
Yep.
So like, we don't have to be as dishonest as they are, but we don't have to offer every single benefit of the doubt either and say, like, maybe in a few years we'll learn that this is Trump's fault. I think Trump owns it. He has hired corrupt people across the entire executive branch. Lots of things are going to go wrong. There's already life-saving science that is not being done because of like these blunderbuss, broad-based cessations of funding at the National Institutes of Health and elsewhere. There's like weird stuff happening because of Trump, and we should make him own all of it.
Absolutely. No, the buck's got to stop somewhere. It stops at the Resolute desk and the orange menace who's behind it. Jeff, as always, I appreciate the thoughts. I know you'll be back. I can't wait to see more from the corruption calendar because, well, I think you're going to have a lot. I think there will be a lot of material to choose from.
Yes. No, sadly, the editing process is going to be difficult. But yeah, thanks for having me.
There you go. Jeff Hauser, executive director of the Revolving Door Project. Make sure you check out their website, therevolvingdoorproject.org. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Have you already bailed? Or are you fighting the good fight? I want to hear it. rick@therickSmithShow.com.
You're listening to WBZH, Hayward's home for the Todd Allbald Show.
This is your local Civic Media radio station.
Want to hear even more? Anytime?
Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. A cloudy sky tonight, few flurries around, and lows in the low teens. For tomorrow, early snow showers, then some sunshine and breezy for the afternoon, highs in the mid-30s. And mostly sunny on Wednesday, highs climb to the upper 20s. Current temp is 30.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Seems everywhere in this state, housing has just gotten so expensive. Our current president ran on promises to help the middle class, and I'd like to know what he's going to do about the housing shortages. I went through the executive orders. I read through the speech transcript a couple of times. Nothing he really said or did in the first couple days has anything to do with helping the middle class.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Yes, we're making discrimination great again. Now, think of all the things we're making great again. You know, pretty much most of the 20th century being repealed and going back to the good old days when the robber barons ruled the roost and workers were, you know, exploitable, disposable, and desperate. Just where our oligarch want us. And what I'm talking about is Donald Trump reversed an executive order that has been in place since 1965. That is Executive Order 11246, which simply states that the executive order that was signed then prohibits federal contractors or federally assisted construction contractors and subcontractors who do more than $10,000 in government business in 1 year from discriminating in employment decisions based on race, color, religion, sex, sexual orientation, gender identity, or national origin. And hey, you know, we're gonna make discriminating people in the workplace great again. And here to share some thoughts on if this is the right move. Is this what we should be doing? Is this what you voted for? Is this what you wanted? That's why I've asked David Borer to come talk with us. David's a union side attorney. David, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick. Thanks for having me on.
So what do we make of this?
Well, I think you're spot on. It's, you know, we're rolling things back 100 years here. And, you know, with barely a head nod to propriety or legality or morality or anything else. Discrimination in the workplace was rampant before this executive order from the 60s. And, you know, it was a little bit of a carrot that the government held out there and said, hey, if you want government contracts, all you have to do is stop, you know, discriminating against your employees. And guess what? Most employers looked at that and said, well, that's a fair deal. Those contracts are lucrative. and they built their businesses around that, and they found that having a diverse workforce was good for the business besides. And yet, you know, the geniuses in charge now want to, you know, roll that back. So I guess, you know, the law of the jungle, right?
Yeah. But here's the thing. These are the people who tell us how much they love the country and how much they believe in the rule of law. And I go, you know, I look at John Roberts and the Roberts courts and the justices that were that we've put in place over the last several years, who all told us that they believe in decided law and stare decisis and they're, you know, balls and strikes and all this stuff. And yet, out of whole cloth, we're just, you know, legislating from the bench and this kind of stuff. It seems like there's an agenda, as I've been saying for a number of years, to overturn the 20th century and return us to the good old days of the 80s and 90s and not the 1980s and 90s.
Right. And, you know, every one of those justices you can name sat in the confirmation hearings in Congress. And like you said, they said, oh, it's decided law and it's, you know, stare decisis and we would never touch it. And the minute they got a chance, they don't just touch it. They like grab it by the throat and try to choke it to death. And we've seen that with, you know, obviously Roe being overturned and so many other things.
And Janus.
And now, you know, a whole raft of new initiatives that, you know, you really have to expect the courts will allow to proceed, right? I mean, the Roberts Court isn't exactly friendly to labor. My old office at AFGE, we won a labor case in two terms ago, but that was a rare, rare situation. And otherwise, the court's been outright hostile to labor.
Let me ask you about that, because, you know, I had a lot of my Red Hat friends telling me, no, Trump isn't associated with Project 2025. He's not going to go after overturning the NLRA. You know, all of this fantasy that my Red Hat friends, maybe it's the dye that bleeds into their brains, but it seems, you know, sitting where I am, that all of those things are absolutely on the table and moving forward. And look, a lot of my union brothers and sisters don't believe that any of that Project 2025 or the assault on labor law is actually going to happen, that Trump's going to be their guy.
Yeah. Well, it was BS when he said it, and it's proving to be BS now. I think if you had a scorecard, two columns. One is a list of initiatives from Project 2025, and the other column is a list of these executive orders. You can match them up pretty good so far. You may not have checked them all off yet, but he hasn't put the pen down either.
Yeah, not yet. And this is why I keep coming back to paying attention to what he's actually doing. There's a lot of the show. There's a lot of the chaos, and there's going to be a lot of chaos. And then there's what's actually getting done. And I look at this executive order as kind of a big deal. Look at the fact that Trump right now, his Justice Department is scrubbing the Justice Department's website of anything having to do with the Capitol rioters' crimes, with the J6 criminals, and basically rewriting history. I look at all this, firing inspectors. There's a lot here that average, everyday working people better raise their head and pay attention to.
No, that's exactly right. The other day they said something to the effect of, oh, America's going to be colorblind now. There's going to be no more. It's going to be a meritocracy. And I thought to myself, well, that's bad for Eric and Don Jr. because if we're colorblind, white privilege is out the freaking window, right? And meritocracy, you know, they didn't get anywhere on their merits. But, you know, we have to be honest. What's underlying a lot of this is just simple racism. You know, he's learned how to play the race card in a way that appeals to a lot of white grievance out there and do it in a way, you know, I don't think you or I would have thought possible 20 years ago that, you could touch that. It's a live wire, but he does it with so much hubris and so much just belligerence that he somehow gets away with it. And of course, all those people don't like to think of themselves as racist, but, you know, you can count the votes on election day. There's a lot of racism there.
Yeah, and look, you know, I do understand that there are things that he brings that people want. You know, I go back to 2016. Look, I called the election in April of 2016. I knew he was going to win. And I've said this before, you know, my family, otherwise known as the basket of deplorables, always racist, always homophobic, always misogynistic, all that stuff, because it's where they grew up and when and all of that. But that never motivated them to vote before. What motivated the vote for him is they actually believed he was going to recreate that economy that made their lives better. It was about the jobs that he promised them. It's about the auto worker jobs, the steel worker jobs. It was about those union jobs on Brook Park Avenue that fed into the Ford and the Chevy plant. It was about the standard of living that those jobs created that they believed. And I still hear remnants of that he's going to... With these tariffs, we're going to bring all these jobs back. And I don't think we're going to bring a single thing back.
No, you look at it, the economists would tell you, no, those jobs aren't coming back. But here's my take. And I've said this for years. How dare the Democrats allow Trump and company to steal this issue to steal basically the working class vote. By not having a program for workers anymore. You know, they, starting with Clinton, they couldn't get their hands dirty supporting workers anymore. They had to line up with Wall Street and the investment bankers and the Hollywood people. And, you know, guess what? That only gets you so far in a fair fight. That brought you a lot of money, and that meant you could win an election in the 90s. But back then, workers, I think, still believed that the Democrats would eventually deliver for them. And now, Trump being elected twice on phony promises to workers, it's partly, largely maybe, the Democrats' fault for not having a real program for working
people. Oh my gosh, Dave, you're blaming Democrats! And it's true. Hey. Look, I go back to Carter, and look, I know, Carter just passed, a great humanitarian, a great human being, but really not a great president, not good. In fact, you know, one of the things he ran on was overturning Taft-Hartley. So, you know, it kind of began with him, where we made a lot of promises and did very little to deliver on them. Look, I voted for Bill Clinton for one reason and one reason only. He was going to bring us strike replacement. And yes, Bob Dole did filibuster it. But once he did that, it was dead. I shook Barack Obama's hand twice. He told me, Rick, we're getting something better than the Employee Free Choice Act. Got nothing. So nothing. I get it. And this is where I'm hoping, by pointing this out, we get better Democrats.
Yeah, let me tell you a story. I was in Boston when I worked for the teachers union, and there was an effort to, after the John Kerry election, there was an effort to sort of mobilize rich Democrats, right? The right doesn't have a corner on all the billionaires. There are some millionaires and billionaires on our side. And so there was a real effort to reach out to those folks and get them to put their money behind these candidates. We should have won with John Kerry, and we didn't. And a lot of those guys couldn't be bothered at the time. So fast forward, we're in another election cycle, and I get invited to this thing at some rich guy's house. The governor was going to speak, whatever. And it was this event to organize some big money people. So I get there, and there's four of them gathered around the kitchen counter. And they're stuffing envelopes, right, for one of the campaigns. And between the four, it's like the old, how many people does it take to screw in a light bulb? Between the four of them, they were like, all right, which way does this go? And they turned the flyer upside down. Should we fold it this way or that way? And then they put it in, and, oh, that doesn't look right. They take it back out, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, we're doomed. You know, just give us your money and help us organize and let us do the work. And that's really the lesson here is, you know, we got in bed with the Wall Street guys, we got in bed with Hollywood, and there aren't enough of them to organize to win an election. And they aren't going to go out and knock on doors anyway. What we need is more workers in unions, millions more workers in unions. And it gives us the opportunity to teach those members about democracy and about the economic issues, and then mobilize them to take back our politics. And in longer term, that's what we have to do. The the Wall Street types are never going to bail us out here.
No, it's the education process that I think that I get from what you were saying that I think is most important. Because when I talk to union members, and I've talked to a lot of them, most don't know what the NLRA is. They don't know what the NLRB is, and because they haven't been exposed to it. It's not something that they talk about at the kitchen table, but it does affect their lives. And if Bezos and Musk are successful and they're able to overturn the parts of the NLRA that actually help workers, this union organizing thing will die in the ability to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, and to stand up to the Musks of the world. That will die along with it.
Well, I have to kind of laugh up my sleeve a little bit because, you know, these people on the right that are, you know, pulling the strings now, they don't know their history. They don't know that before the National Labor Relations Act was passed, employers were begging for legislation to put some guardrails around the right to strike, right? And they don't know that the initial guardrails worked for a while, but it wasn't enough, and labor scared them to death by the end of the 40s. And so they came in wanting more, and they got Taft-Hartley to really sort of tighten the screws. If they want to repeal the whole thing, go ahead. I know my history. You know, we'll dial it back to the 20s, and we'll show you what unfettered striking is all about.
Yeah, but we both know that they're not going to repeal the whole thing. Just the few parts in it that are helpful to workers. Those controls that you were talking about, those will remain.
Well, we'll see. I mean, they're saying it's unconstitutional. You know, the court could throw out the whole damn thing.
And look, I do know a lot of people who are on board with that idea. Because, as I've said before, maybe you'll agree, I think the NLRA was a peace treaty because workers were tearing the country apart brick by brick because they demanded better wages, hours, conditions. They went overseas to fight fascism over there. They came home and they built the most prosperous working class in the history of humanity. And they did that person to person and in the streets, not with politicians.
Yeah. No, and it's the same in like, my old job with the flight attendants, the Railway Labor Act, you know, that was hammered out by representatives of the pilots union and representatives of the industry. And then they went together to Congress and said, look, all these strikes, we're never going to get this industry off the ground. We've got to have, you know, this mediation procedure. And it was a joint effort that set that in place. Now, I could, you know, I've got my problems with the Railway Labor Act, but, you know, before these laws went in, management was just as anxious as we were to have something on the books to make this a more orderly system. And the current round of, crash and burners are, you know, not even aware of that history, I really believe.
Well, they may learn it over again because, sadly, I think you're right. I don't know what our Supreme Court will do, but I don't have great faith in them to stand up and protect workers or their rights. So last line of questioning I've got for you, because, you know, as this stuff happens, I've been saying the solutions will come out of their savagery. The suffering that happens because of what they do should wake us up. The only time Americans seem to unite is when there's chaos and tragedy and suffering, and maybe we're heading towards that moment. So you as a union lawyer, you as someone who pays attention to this, what are you watching for in the coming weeks and months for Trump to do, or the Department of Labor, or any of those, one of those folks? What are you keeping an eye on?
Yeah, I've been an organizer in addition to being an attorney most of my career, and I've run a lot of organizing campaigns. And we always used to say, you know, the boss is our best ally, right? They can't help themselves. They always step on people's toes. They always fire people unfairly. They always mistreat people, put in arbitrary rules, whatever it is. And it's the same with this, right? And I think the organizing we've seen over the last 3 or 4 years, Starbucks and the UAW and the big airline campaigns at Delta, are driven in part by, you know, people who did get their hopes up that Trump was going to do something for workers. And then they were like, oh, that was an empty bag. We're worse off than we ever were. And so they started, you know, looking around. We've talked to workers who said, well, I had to look up on Wikipedia what a union was. And I figured out, oh, well, maybe this could help. And away they went. And so I really think, you know, as I said, the Democrats didn't deliver when they were in office. Trump didn't really deliver for workers despite all the promises, which created, I think, a backlash. Biden did some good things, but, you know, too little too late. And I think that kind of leaving the workers hanging is already manifest in some of the organizing activity you see, and that's going to just increase. These young workers, you know, they're smart enough not to believe the bull too much longer, and they start talking to each other. You see it in tech, you see it in communications, some of the new media folks, you see it in Starbucks. People who don't have what you would think of as a lot of natural leverage they're in jobs that were once thought of as replaceable are realizing that if they have a union, that makes a big difference. And now we have to really deliver. You know, I worry about the Starbucks thing, for example. They've made some breakthroughs there. We got to get it all the way across the finish line and get them a contract so that other workers then will say, oh, look what these folks at Starbucks achieved.
Yep.
Let's do that.
No, look, right? I say all the time, David, you know, as a kid growing up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, when the neighbor got a job at Ford, a UAW job, their lives got better immediately. There was food at the end of the month. Kids got secondhand bikes. They eventually got a secondhand car, eventually moved out of the community altogether. So that message of union job, better life, I got as a young child. How do I get that? And I think we need to be that society again that goes, hey, how do we make lives better? And I think unions are a key to getting to that solution.
Yep. And, no, I think that's right. And you know, I grew up in the other corner of Ohio, Northwest Ohio, surrounded by auto plants, glass plants, all kinds of auto parts, whatever. And my best friend in life had, you know, eye trouble when he was a kid. And it wasn't until his dad got a union job in a UAW plant in Toledo that they had an eye doctor's office in the UAW regional office in Toledo. And he went down to the union office and that doctor got his eyes straightened out, gave him the right kind of glasses. And, you know, there's a supporter for life, right? I mean, you know, boom. Yep,
that's simple.
And we just have to repeat that. And our density fell so low that there are lots of people who haven't had that experience, don't even know what a union is, don't know what a contract is, you know, don't know what's possible. And so with all these current campaigns, we have to finish, get a good contract, and then build on that.
There you go. David, I appreciate you taking a little time for me. I hope you'll come back and share some thoughts as as what's coming comes.
Yeah, here it comes.
There you go.
We're ready.
Thanks so much, David Borer, union side attorney. I want to hear your thoughts. You got any union stories? You got any childhood memories? I want to hear it. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1950. The cost of a first-class stamp was 3 cents. And starting on this day, one of the options for first-class postage bore the image of U.S. labor leader Samuel Gompers. The British-born Gompers was a founder and longtime head of the American Federation of Labor. The Postal Service authorized 112 million copies of the Gompers stamp. He was not the only labor leader to be commemorated with a stamp. A. Philip Randolph, head of the First National Black Union, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, was honored in 1989. 5 years later, George Meany, who led the AFL-CIO for nearly two decades, was featured. Cesar Chavez, the co-founder of the United Farm Workers, was pictured in 2003. In 2013, the U.S. Postal Service issued a series of stamps titled Made in America, Building a Nation. This set of stamps featured 12 historic black and white photos of men and women at work. One was of a welder working on the Empire State Building. Others featured a miner, a textile worker, and a railroad worker. The stamps included 11 images by Lewis Hine, a famous photographer of working people. Secretary of Labor Tom Perez said, "Stamps are like a miniature American portrait gallery. They are an expression of our values and a connection to our past. That's why it's so fitting that this series depicts Americans at work. These iconic images tell a powerful story about American economic strength and prosperity. These men and women and millions like them really did build a nation. If you could pick one working class image to be featured on a stamp, what would you choose? A politician, a labor leader, or a nurse, construction worker, or postal worker? Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You know, David's right. We need that education process of explaining what a union is. And I try and do that every chance I get. You know, for instance, I was at the grocery store the other day, and the cashier was complaining about how many hours she was working and how her wages weren't keeping up, and how, you know, the price of the food that she's selling was out of her reach. And I said, yeah, look, this is why you should join a union. There are union grocery stores across this country where people make better wages, better hours, better conditions. You know, all of that stuff have more say. And she goes, we don't need no union here. I'm going, you just complained that you're earning poverty wages. You just complained that your benefits are terrible. You just complained that you're used and abused, and they tell you if you don't like it, there's the door, and there's really nowhere else for you to go. You've just said all of that, and yet I'm offering you a way forward. And understand, it's an indoctrination that has happened in this country for 30, 40 years. That is, you know, private corporations are good, unions are bad. Unions put people out of business. And you go, no, no. A union's never put a company out of business. That's the job of the CEO. They make that call. Unions want to open the books and go, hey, how much did our workers' wealth, how much was created by their work? How much did they create? And then we want some of that. Companies that are wildly profitable should share that. Because what we do know is when times are hard, corporate America comes back with their hand out going, oh, we need concessions. And unions almost to a fault go, okay, we're going to save the company. We're going to bail the company out by getting less wages or less benefits. There needs to be a solid education process. I look at what I'm going through right now. If it weren't for my union health insurance, I don't know what my life would be, what I'd be going through right now. My wife, as you may know, has been in the hospital since September 12th when a 77-year-old woman driving a school van turned left in front of her while she was riding her motorcycle and just basically ran her over. And she has been in and out of you know, intensive care, of LTACs, of rehab hospitals, back to intensive care, back to rehab hospitals. We've been bouncing around. It's been my insurance, my union fund, that has been by my side fighting to get the care that she needs, while the doctor is saying, hey, we think this is the best place for her, but yeah, she can't stay. We need to take back those institutions of health care, of retirement security, and of wages. And you do that by organizing people. And for me, it started very young. Look, I told David there, you know, I grew up in a housing project. We were poor and knew it. And when the neighbor got that job at Ford, everyone noticed there was food at the end of the month. Not everybody in the neighborhood had that. There was opportunity. There was upward mobility. And that idea of union job, better life is something that me and my generation, I think, got. Because we had, you know, 25, 28% union density. Now that the Republicans and corporate America have done such a great job of crushing unions, so few people know what they are, but they know they're against them. Like my cashier friend. So for me, we're in a moment where the anger is real and the solutions that Donald Trump is throwing out there are not. What is real is what David talked about, Starbucks organizing, the UAW organizing, you know, auto plants in the South, the Teamsters organizing Amazon. That is going to make lives better. That is going to give working people an opportunity, you know, to live that American dream, to do better, to have food at the end of the month, opportunities for their children, or when tragedy strikes, help. That's why I'm grateful for the union card that I carry in my wallet. I want to hear your thoughts. You got a union story you want to share? Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com is how you get it to me. You miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcasts, you will find ours. As always, make sure you check out freespeech.org and all of the great content there at Free Speech TV. And as always, appreciate you being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is the Buzz of the North.
WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Richard Cantu. A mid-afternoon security scare at the U.S. Capitol Monday.
Pictures from the scene show officers blocking access to the south door of the Capitol near the House chamber and huddling over a bottle and other assorted evidence on the ground. Capitol Police say the suspect claimed to have a Molotov cocktail and a knife. That suspect was quickly taken into custody.
ABC's Stephen Portnoy. Voting 68-29, the Senate confirmed billionaire investor Scott Bessent as Treasury Secretary. He gets the task of cutting taxes and curbing deficits, all while advancing a tariff plan. Bessent will be the first openly gay individual to be Treasury Secretary. In northwest Indiana, the Jasper County deputy curbed Matthew Huddle for a traffic stop. Investigators say there was an altercation, and the deputy wound up fatally shooting Huddle, who was found to be in possession of a firearm. Days prior, Huddle, a January 6th insurrectionist, was pardoned by President Trump. This is ABC News. At the United Nations...